Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and my guest is Ronnie Carcenti, who's a faculty member in the Department of Science Teaching at the Weizmann Institute of Science, which is in Israel. And Ronnie, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to be talking about Ronnie's recent article that was in ZDM, Mathematics Education, in the volume 53 of ZDM. And that article is entitled Implementing Professional Development Programs for Mathematics Teachers at Scale, What Counts as Success? And we have a project here at the University of Missouri that we're working on. We're trying to think about professional development and how to try to have it spread and have it sort of take off. So that's really one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about your work. But when I have a new guest, I always also like to go back and just sort of get a little bit of a sense of where you came from and your history. And so I wanted to ask you where you did your doctoral studies and what was the focus of your dissertation back in graduate school?
Okay, well, that in fact is very different from what I do today. So I did my doctoral degree in the Hebrew University in Jerusalem under the guidance of Professor Shlomo Wiener, a colleague and a friend, and an inspiration also. What I did back then is really not about professional development at all. I was a high school teacher at the time, and my students kept asking me, so why do we need that? You know, the million-dollar question, why do we need to learn all that? We're never going to use it. No one remembers it anyway. And I heard so much of that that I decided that this is a really good research question. My question was, what if I do take people many years after school, many years after they graduated high school, like in their late 30s or 40s, and I ask them, what do you really remember from math lessons? So either emotionally or really the real math, what do you remember? And this was the subject of my dissertation. So I interviewed 24 people. It was a multiple case study, people who are not involved in math anymore. So people from different professional areas. And that was really interesting for me to see what they remember emotionally and what kind of math do they remember. I also published a little about that if someone's interested to read. I really like doing this dissertation.
That million-dollar question is still around, I hear. So I think it's probably still relevant.
Yeah, but probably will be also, always.
But on the topic of professional development that you've been thinking about and working on more recently, I wanted to ask you, what was your experience with professional development in math education? And what was sort of the origin of this idea for the ZDM article where you dug into these ideas about professional development at scale?
So when I came to do my postdoc at the Weizmann Institute, I was involved in professional development in the project that later on became the Schlav project, which is reported in this article. And it's about helping low-track students, or you could say students at risk, to succeed in the final matriculation exams in mathematics. So that's first when I became involved with professional development. And we had many courses, as I say in this article, we had many courses for teachers, later on developing to a different kind of professional development. And I think that the ideas that are now articulated in this paper, they really took time to ripe, you know what I mean? It's like I was thinking about them for, I think, more than 15 years. Until they were ripe enough to appear in something sort of coherent that I could share with others. But I was intrigued even from the start with this question of what is success? And I think this started because on the one hand, I had all those administrators, you know, the funding agencies and the ministry administrators asking me questions like, okay, so how many schools do you have? So how many teachers are involved? How many students are benefiting from this? And the numbers were not always so compelling. But on the other hand, I was in the field. I was talking to students and they were learning something. And they were learning something that they did not learn before. And they were changing the way they thought about math. For me to have a communication with a student who was failing, and now they think differently about math. I thought this is a success. What do I care what the numbers are? But of course, the numbers matter. So all this balance between how many and what is actually going there, it was all the time in my mind. And when we began the other project that I mentioned, the Video LM project, these questions bothered us again. And so I was asked to give a plenary talk in a conference about implementation. And that's when I started to get all my ideas together. And after the talk is when people told me that this was really something that they learned from, or something that was maybe reorganizing thoughts that they already have. And that's when I thought that it's now maybe worth a paper.
Yeah. And I can second that opinion about, you know, I've also been thinking with colleagues and working with Zandra DiRaggio and Amber Candela, thinking about professional development and what we want to define as success. And to me, what your paper did was it gave some clarity and some language for the sorts of things that we were trying to think about, we were trying to grapple with. And so I did find that really helpful. I want to get into some of those ideas and the terminology that you sort of put out there. So one of the things that you talk about is upscaling, or trying to scale up the professional development. I wonder if you could describe for us a little bit about what you see as the difference between professional development that has upscale of settings versus upscale of values.
Yes. So I think that this is the terms that I decided to use for the two sides that I was talking about before. So upscale of settings is actually answering the question of how many. It could be how many countries, if it's a project that it's importing from country to country, or how many districts, how many schools, how many teachers, how many students, how many textbooks, how many is because what we want eventually is to have our ideas, if we think they're good, spreading over more and more people who will benefit from them. So that's the upscale of settings. And it's actually more easy to define what's success in that term. The more you have, the more it's successful. So if you have only one school following your ideas, that's probably not a good upscale. If you have 10 schools, it's a better upscale. If you have 1,000 schools, well, in Israeli terms, it's almost impossible. But it will be wonderful if it could happen. Don't forget that the scales between Israel and United States are very, very different. For example, if we have 4,000 teachers in our Video LM website, that's like more than half of the math teachers in Israel. So the scales are a bit different. Anyway, upscales of values is the other side of this equation. That's the term I chose for describing what I felt as something that you want to be spread. This is something that you don't want to give up, like the credo of the project, something that is so valuable that it doesn't matter how many schools or teachers or students are doing it, but they do it in a way that preserves the values which were at the core when you started your way. Because I believe that each of us, we don't start a PD just like that. We think a lot about it, not only about the design and about the administration and about how to do it, but we start with something we believe in. We start with something that we think this is going to be beneficial, either for a subgroup of students or for certain teachers or in certain places, but we start with something we believe in. And what we want to see and call success is if this something has been preserved. And sometimes even if it surprised us in ways that are even more valuable than what we thought at first. So I hope this is saying something about the difference. Of course, they're not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. We would like to see more numbers and the values preserved, but sometimes this is not very possible. I mean, sometimes it could be that one comes at the expense of the other, and that's where the dilemma starts.
Mm-hmm. You also distinguish between professional development replication, adaptation, and reproduction. And again, to me, this is also helpful to sort of have these terminologies, these categories to clarify some things that we might see in professional development or in, you know, additional professional development efforts. So I wonder if you could just briefly sort of, again, there's more details in the article, and I'm definitely directing people to ZDM to find the article, but could you just give us a summary version of that replication, adaptation, and reproduction of professional development?
So replication is basically when you want the idea to look sort of exactly or as exact as it can be to the original idea. So you say, this is how I want the PD to look. I want the PD to look more or less the same anywhere it is implemented. So repeating itself, replicating itself. I think that people already know that there is no such thing as exact replication. It will always be a little different. But the hope that it will be as little as possible and as much as possible similar to the original design, that's replication. It's also called fidelity, in hope that if I keep the design and I keep the conditions and I keep the way that I teach other people to implement this PD, then the results will be as similar as possible. That's replication. Personally, in many conditions, I do not think it is possible at all to do replications. But I can think of situations where this is possible and maybe where this is even necessary. But I won't get into that now. Okay. When we talk about adaptation, this means that the core ideas are getting adapted within different contexts to suit what the audience there needs. So the core ideas get preserved, and the aspiration is to keep it as much as possible similar to the design, but taking into account that there might be other goals in this context, other conditions that you need to take into account, that you might need to negotiate what you're doing there so that you will have an audience that will buy out what your ideas are spread out for. So that's adaptation. So the third model, reproduction, is quite similar to adaptation in that it does look different in each setting. But there is a nuance here that I want to mention. Here, the values are what's important. So you do not look that much on how the conditions altered your design and what adaptations were made, but you are looking more at were the values of this design preserved. So you are looking specifically to see if the credo of your project was preserved, even though the adaptations can be, I would say, even sometimes extreme. The metaphor I used for this is reproduction by human beings, so that no one really thinks that his children will look exactly the same, nor that they will be adaptations of him or herself. You want your core ideas, your core family ideas, to stay after you're gone, but everyone does it in a different way. And you do not go and look at how different things are. What's interesting for you is that the credo, the values, are still there. That's what you're looking at. So it might look very similar from the outside, but I think maybe for research, these terms are different because you look at different things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. So like from a practical side, if people are just implementing PD, they might think about the main distinction as replication. We're trying to do it with fidelity. We don't have a lot of degrees of freedom. That's one side. Mm-hmm. And then practically speaking, the other side is we have some freedom. We can make some adjustments. We can tweak some things. So it might just be sort of like two categories if you're thinking practically. But if you're trying to get into the deeper theories and research perspectives on the professional development, then that's when you sort of get the three categories. You want to distinguish between adaptation and reproduction. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yes, this is very nicely put. I would take it maybe to an example. For example, what happens if you look at a site that you have your ideas implemented in and the adaptation is so extreme that you are not sure even that it's the same project? So you would not even call it adaptation. But then you talk to people about what they have learned, and you see that they have learned the things that you want them to learn, or at least the basic things that you want. For example, in the video LM, the core thing is reflection and not being judgmental towards the work of colleagues and not thinking of one thing as best practice and the other is not good enough, but trying to understand why people do math teaching differently and what goals do they have, and step into their shoes and try to reflect on different possibilities. So maybe while implementing the PD, it doesn't look like how we, the designers, it's very, very different. It's too different maybe from how we, the designers, pictured how it's going to take place. But when you talk to the teachers or maybe read what they wrote, read their feedback, you see that these core values of reflection not being judgmental are preserved. So that's why I call it reproduction. So I would say in such a case, the ideas were reproduced. There is an upscale of values, but maybe the adaptation is too different from
it's kind of beyond a recognizable adaptation. Yeah. And another way to think about reproduction is this is sort of like, it's a descendant, you know, like it's a descendant of the earlier idea, but it still has some of that same genealogy, you know, some of those same core ideas that are in there.
Yes.
I think it helps that you did give that kind of example. In the article, you also talk about some examples in Israel of professional development projects that are happening. I wonder if you could just say a little bit about how you see this kind of framework of thinking about PD. How do you see that playing out in Israel?
So in answering your question, let me go back first to the project that I call Shlav, which is meant to help at-risk students pass the matriculation exam in mathematics. So when we conceived this project, we were thinking about something that is so very different from how it looks now, because 15 years have passed, and I can't even begin to tell you how the ideas have altered. So we thought about the essence was, how do we get students to think about mathematics, even if they are not used to it? How do we get students to understand what they're doing and not just do it as with procedures that they are getting from the teacher? But to do that, we conceived the project with materials and with ways to talk to teachers and with going into classrooms. And the PD was so clear to us how it's going to look. If you read the paper, it's called a personalized PD because you tailor it to the school you're in and even to the one teacher you're helping. But years have passed. I'm not there anymore. Someone else is now running it. And I actually know that the way it looks now, they're working now with cities, which is parallel maybe to districts in the United States, and not, they don't do it with particular teachers anymore. So how is this the same upscale of the same project? And I collected some data before I wrote the paper, and the numbers, again, are quite impressive, again, in Israeli terms. But what's more impressive is, again, the core belief. What is still there is the belief that students do not need to just have the procedure of the question in order to answer it. They need to understand what they're doing. And for that, we have, maybe I would even say it, sacrifice or negotiate what we want them to know and what not. So, for example, perhaps they will not be familiar with several formulas. We take that into account. But they will get other alternative ways of solving questions. And this is still there after so many years. It's still there because I'm hearing from people that this idea is there. But it's not only that it's not replication, I don't even think that I can say that it's adaptation anymore because it's altered so much. But it still has the name and it still has the idea. And still, when I meet teachers who came across this and they're telling me how they shifted their way of thinking what students who are at risk can do and what they cannot do and how they can mediate the material for them, I say, okay, this is us. This is the project. This is it. It's a, like you said, it's a distant child, but it's a child. It's a relative of ours. It's working. Yeah. About VideoLem, the other project, I think it's too early to say, but I can say that we are now making ourselves an adaptation to this project. This project was about teachers watching videos of other teachers that they do not even know. And through six lenses that we provided them, they analyzed the lessons, again, with no judgment, just trying to understand what the teacher was doing, what her goals were, What were her dilemmas? What decisions she took during the lesson? How can we all learn from that? In one word, reflection. So we ourselves are now adapting it to a different project where the teachers will not only watch teachers they do not know, but eventually they will get to do some lesson study, design a lesson for themselves, and then film it. And then they again will look at it with the same lenses, but it's not the same as it was before. It's another, we adapted it. So it's again, an adaptation. And I can assume with the PLCs that we now have that are not video LM anymore, the different project, I can assume that this will go on with the core values running, but the implementation not looking even a bit similar to where we started from. And I think that not only we do need to accept that, we maybe even need to want it, because I'll go back to what I said before. I don't think it's really possible to take an idea and expect that in years and years, it will stay the same or even similar or even a little similar to what you designed in the first place. Maybe we should even aspire that people will own this idea in their own way and deliver it in ways as long as it's faithful to the values. So that's why this is important to me. Does this answer your question, Sam?
Yeah, it does. And it also ties it back to why that distinction between the upscale of settings and upscale of values is important, right? Because the upscale of values is the thing that you actually are going to trace through the lineage, like through the adaptations and then even through the reproductions. You know, it's not about counting settings anymore, because if you count settings, it's like, do you only count settings if it's like a true replication? And if it deviates, then it's like, oh, do I still count that as part of the settings that it has reached? Or do I start a different count? Like, oh, the original one reached 20 districts, but then it adapted a little bit and then it went to 10 more districts. And then it kind of was a reproduction that went to 30 more districts. Like there, the counting starts to get a little bit convoluted. But if you're tracing the upscale of values, that's where you see the through line. You can sort of see the continuity of, yeah, it adapted. And yeah, it even started to change quite a bit, but it was still scaling that value, because that value is marching onward and it's still hopefully kind of taking hold.
I really like how you framed it. I really like that. Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you. This is all just, you know, the thoughts that your article has prompted. I wanted to ask you one more thing, and it kind of goes beyond the article, but do you have some recommendations or do you have some thoughts, broadly speaking, about where professional development efforts should go? Like, should they go towards adapting things that have been successful? Should they go towards reproduction? Should they, you know, really focus on values? Like, what are just your thoughts about guidance for our field if we're working on PD?
Well, that's a tough one. Because I think our field, even just looking at PDs, even just PDs in math, even just PDs in secondary math, the field is so diversified with so many goals that I think that will be difficult to give one recommendation that suits all, and it will be even maybe a little irresponsible on my side. But I can, based on my own opinions, point to some directions that I think that are promising. But again, it's not something that I think it's something that a lot of people are aware of. And you can see the talk in conferences and stuff about that. So one thing is the PLCs, the professional learning communities. This is starting to be flourishing in many places. And there's a reason for that, because I think it's time that teachers really take a genuine part in their professional development. And one of the strongest places where you could do that is in a PLC, so that all the participants are partners in deciding what their learning should look like, what goals they want to pursue, how do they want to pursue them. And of course, usually, but not always, with the help of facilitators or a help of a project. And I see in Israel that this is really, really a growing trend in, I would say, the last 5 or 6 years in some areas such as physics even more. And I believe in that direction, because I think it's harder to organize and it's harder to implement, but it's worth it. The challenge is worth it. Because again, I think that teachers should own their professional development, and this is one way to do it. The other thing that I can say is, video. Of course, video has been around for many, many years, and Of course, we are not the people who invented the video use, and there are many, many video uses. But I am not sure that this direction has been how would I say, squeezed to the end. That lemon is not fully squeezed. I mean, there are many things that you could do with video that haven't been done yet. And I think that teachers, at least, again, from my experience in Israel, are very impressed with the power of video to help them in many directions, either to see how other people are teaching, either to see how can a new idea be taught, and I see it in real life, so it's not only an idea that I don't know how it's going to get to the field. And of course, to discuss so many aspects of teaching that are so complex, and the video can tell us about them. So I really think that this is important. And if I may add, all this video technology is something that we have now learned to appreciate even more because of all the COVID situation. So many, many sessions and lessons and PD sessions and actual mathematics lesson have moved to being broadcasted by Zoom, which is a form of video. So learning to understand this this tool and its affordances and its limitations, I think is very important, and we have learned a lot. I'll just give one example. When the COVID started and we thought about moving all our professional development to Zoom, that is to video, we said, oh, this is not going to work. We really need the face-to-face interaction. We really need people to be able to see the what they're working on in terms of the math, to look behind one's shoulder and to see how they're solving it. This won't work. But eventually we had no choice. I think that without the COVID, we would have never thought about it, although people were coming to the Weitzman from very far places. So they had to invest a lot of time in reaching us. And with a Zoom, it was so easy. But still, we have not thought about it before the COVID. And when the COVID forced us to do that, we saw that there are a lot of advantages. For example, we can re-watch the session, all of us. If we want to relearn something that we have all discussed in the PD, we can re-watch it. When was that even? I mean, for research purposes, we recorded sessions, but not as a something that you do all the time. And on the Zoom, it's just recording. You can watch it again. You can make sure that the work that you distributed for the next session is something that really rose out of what people really wanted, and many, many advantages that I think that are now only beginning to be researched. And I think it's a very strong direction. Mm-hmm. Not that I wish that the COVID will stay. No. I don't.
Yeah, no, I hear you there. Ronnie Carcenti is from the Weitzman Institute of Science, and we've been talking about her article in ZDM, Mathematics Education, on implementing professional development programs for mathematics teachers at scale. Ronnie, I have one final question that I usually ask. This is from a friend of mine named Aaron Brackenecki, and I've just been using it for years. But if you imagine yourself not in mathematics education at all, is there an alternative career that you can imagine for yourself in either a fantastical world or in a realistic world? Is there something else you could be doing?
Well, I'm not sure that you're going to believe me, Sam. First of all, this is a very nice question. But I think that if I was not a math educator, then perhaps I would be a baker. Hmm. I would bake cakes. I love baking cakes. I actually took a semi-professional course on that several years ago. I really love it. I just don't have much time to do it. But products are nice, so do people tell to me. And I'm very intrigued about how you take ingredients and, you know, it's even maybe similar to what we have talked. You change this recipe a little here and a little there, and you get something that is a little different, but maybe has some relationship with the original recipe.
Right.
So I like this kind of play, and I think I would be a baker. I think so.
I can believe that. That sounds good. Well, Ronnie, thanks so much for sharing about the work and for your ideas, which, like I said, we're taking and thinking about in our own projects here. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Sam. I enjoyed it.